questions you might have, so fire away.
Yes.
Can you write the names of the titles of the books that, for example, Hypatia by Maria?
DZ.
John Lewis.
DZ. ELSKA. Maria Ilska. But if you just, if you Google Hypatia, you'll get it all.
I haven't seen it.
Anybody have any more definitive information on that? But I believe that. I have the book.
That's how you spell Hypatia.
Okay. What about your book? Can you write it up?
I can spell my name. I think they taught me good. My last name is this. There's not too many of us. And so I'm just out there. That's right.
Black coat.
Black tunic.
Okay, yes.
Okay. One is very two questions for the first. The connection with Hermes is Megistus, because I don't remember the
name. Okay.
And then, if there is a connection with the quantum science that Indian, I don't remember his name, I cannot pronounce it anyway,
I think it's one of the big questions right now is that idea of healing that split between the physical and the spiritual. And sometimes when I give talks, I use this as an example. It's like we can, particularly with alchemy, this is where I know this is what I'll talk about. You can sometimes read an alchemical text, okay, and it will say, okay, we'll approach it as a physical effect, right, as a physical process, and you can actually do that and say, okay, fine, what they really mean here is copper, what they really mean here is this, and you go through this process, and eventually something like this will end up. Or you could read it as tilt your head the other way, and you could read it as a spiritual process, okay, what you're doing is you're breaking down these and opening stuff up and moving things along and so on. The fact is that they're both simultaneously. And the way I'll sometimes explain it is if you take an image, stereographic image, right? We've all seen these things in the little click viewfinders where you can see something in 3D. You can take one image and it's accurate, points to everything else that is supposedly representing, and you understand it, and you can say, okay, fine, that's physical, that's physical, that's physical. I get it. Take the other stereo stop in this pair, call that the spiritual, and say, oh yeah, it also is very accurate, shows what it is, and yeah, I get it, that's spiritual, that's physical. But it's when we kind of put the two together, there's another phenomenon that happens that neither one of them, in our understanding of this is spiritual and this is physical, happens, and that's that experience of 3D. Right? When that happens, you can't even explain that to someone. And so this is what it's like when you come across a text. What the alchemy kind of shows in some of the philosophical approaches is a way kind of back to that. And so I think a lot of these questions that are being asked, okay, in terms of, okay, quantum physics is showing this, the observer having an effect upon the phenomenon and so on and so forth. My feeling is that I think at some point we'll kind of get back to some of these ideas. We'll just come around the long way around, but I think this is true. I don't know if that answers the question, or just kind of
I was thinking this long way, but right. After all, we want to go back.
Right. And that's another thing, too, I was just saying.
It all connects. It's all connected.
Right. But I also think, too, we often think of this as the split occurring with the advent of the Enlightenment and things like that, where the rational and the empirical and all these things. But I think in a lot of ways that development of this very rationalistic side of us is perhaps at a very important step in our evolution. I think now the game is, okay, how do you start to reintegrate these things?
I'm sorry, about
him,
this
who he is?
Yeah.
He's a quasi-mythical, mystical character. Okay. He supposedly had been a contemporary of Moses. There's other things like that. And what he is supposed to be responsible for is bringing the sciences and the arts and medicine to humanity. There's a lot of other different aspects of him too, and perhaps I mean, Ralph would like to speak to that. But that's essentially, and there was a body of work ascribed to him, known as the Corpus Hermeticum, but that deals with the ascent of the soul and then some practical aspects of it also. So that's essentially the thumbnail.
Just that the assumption is in most of the works on Hypatia is that she was teaching, it was a Hermetic teaching that she was involved in, and that in all probability that makes a great deal of sense. That's what her father was teaching, only what she did, because she was also an advisor to the political life of Alexandria, is that she also moved into a more or a less esoteric teaching as part of her broader view, I guess, less concerned with the inner world and the esoteric world, and more involved in the greater world of Alexandria, which is one of the reasons she ran so strongly afoul of the church in 415.
So my question kind of follows on. It's about this notion of, you use words about the moment of insight, and scientists talk about this moment when they're in labs and they see things in slides, I guess. I'm thinking about it as the world I come from, and we live in New York, so it's knowledge workers, people who write software. They say, I'm in the zone, or I'm in the zone, we're in the zone. And it's like this amazing moment of building things, and also modeling, financial modeling. I'm thinking transmutation. You talk about all these amazing words that I can't help but thinking, well, in the world of finance, we're doing this with mathematics and all these things. However, it's used. Is it used for good? Is it used for bad?
Yes,
it has the potential. But also, the people who are doing it are happy as workers, you know. And the people who are making metal and working in factories are kind of brutalized today, you know. And the people at the highest levels of knowledge work are in these zone jobs, and I'm in one of those. I do that.
Well, any creative area.
So any creative area. So you're in a zone job, and you have all this great approbation that comes to you. But, and I'm wondering, is this a similar experience for us today in our world of very weird material? Weird,
I think
things?
It could be. I think it could be if you had the framework that would point you in the direction that this was, which was the whole idea of seeing the underlying unity of being and finding some kind of approach to it and unity with it. I think that's absent for the most part. I think most people who are working in creative areas, and I think when you really start to look at, and that's actually one of the things, the Emerald Tablet is actually a description of the creative process.
Right.
And if you break it down like that and understand that what he's talking about is creation, and not just cosmic creation, but macrocosmic creation, well, that's what it is talking about. It's also talking about, from this beginning moment of the blank page, how does creation begin and manifest? And that's what it talks about. But it's also talking about using creation as the roadmap back. So you get the circulation that goes on. And again, to the alchemical process, it becomes a very material, external process that you're doing that's also reflecting. What's missing from a lot of the stuff today is nothing necessarily wrong with it, but you know, it's pursuit of money or ego. It's on a horizontal plane where this is what we're after. And nothing wrong with that,
They say that the potential of all these derivative instruments is the correct allocation of resources,
Scary truck. I hear derivative.
Of course, it doesn't seem to happen that way. But in theory, that's the justification for it. In perfect, beautiful words written on paper.
But I think it really is, and any of the alchemical, almost all the alchemical tradition starts with kind of ethics and morality. Without that, you don't go much further.
They use it as their justification for all this financial hocus pocus. But anyway.
I know someone wants to talk to you.
I don't mean to hog this, so.
Thank you.
But it jumped in. Okay.
Do you have a question on something other than alchemy? Or does everyone want to talk about
They want to have a bowl. They're trying to suck.
You want to say you want to do this?
Okay. In terms of the history of alchemy, in early Greek alchemy, the focus, well, question for you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, was I called up? Go ahead, that's fine. Okay.
Okay.
Well, you have the floor.
I love alchemy. It's very mystical and magical, and my discovering alchemy just like changed my whole life. And I had, in the midst of what was happening to me, I was reading a lot about it, and I read that the ancients would actually use the symbols to change the consciousness of people, mm-hmm. the actual physical symbols. And I'm wondering if you know about that, or if you can talk about that. You've heard about that?
Yeah, I have, but I think it's going to start to take us a little off and a little too deep and a little too right off the top. But yes, I mean, essentially this
is...
Do
we want to go deep?
There are other
Brian will do a whole series on alchemy.
Okay.
And
it's just I'm afraid it's taking us a little too far off the topic, and I don't want to necessarily.
Well, maybe in the same vein, my question is, in early Greek alchemy, the focus was on the four elements of earth, water, air, fire, and then the quintessence. But by the Middle Ages, the focus became on the elements of mercury and sulfur and then salt, which was brought in by Paracelsus. But that transition seems very kind of vague. There was a period through the Arabic, and I'm curious how you would describe that if you want to get into that.
This starts to get
briefly.
Into very, very briefly. Okay, very, very briefly. All those ideas of what he's talking about is a way of categorizing the material world and breaking it down into fire, air, earth, water, and all of these basic elements.
Because this was the use of the procedures.
Exactly. And then beyond that, there became an idea, another reconceptualization of it, breaking it down into threes, which was mercury, sulfur, and salt, all kind of dealing with the ideas of structure, form, volatility, and energy, those kind of ideas there. That the universe is made up of these various things. You strip it down, you can then reconfigure it, move it back up, and have something new. That's alchemical theory in a nutshell.
Brian, yes. There's also a fragment of Heraclitus that mm-hmm. suggests that he was doing alchemy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And it said, as I recall now, it says, students came to the door, to Heraclitus' door, and they looked in and he was working over his stove. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Don't be afraid, come in, the gods are here also."
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it's also true that each of the elements were given the names of the gods at that point too. So, but that's essentially how those three things,
could be through the period that, we're jumping over, which was the civilization of in the Arab world in Baghdad and mm-hmm. Andalusia that really
and that's where those ideas
were those
came
were kind of tra- made that transformation from
that's where it
evolved
from those four into three. But again, it starts to really drill down into fine detail here. Any other questions for
The tomb of Alexander was robbed at some point. And there's multiple theories about where the body went. I was just curious if you know, or what your thoughts on where the body was moved. Because I heard one theory that it was moved to Venice, to the St. Mark's Cathedral. I was wondering if you'd heard that, or if you...
I think that's highly doubtful that would be the case. My assumption is that it was probably destroyed, and the whole mausoleum was destroyed. And that Alexander would have been seen as, again, a pagan figure that, when the church took dominance, wasn't going to be respected.
What became of the four children that Cleopatra had with Alexander?
The child that she had with Caesar was murdered because he was considered by Octavian, because they tracked him down when he was about 14 years old and killed him because he was a genuine heir of Caesar, a threat to Octavian. And as for the other children with Mark Antony, I think they were allowed to live out their life in relative obscurity. That's as I recall.
They disappeared from history. They were brought up by Octavian's sister.
Was there an Arab time before the Ottomans in Alexandria? And
in an Arab time before the Ottomans.
Yeah, anything happened?
Yeah, well, I did a whole talk on this a few weeks ago. Really the next great library after Alexandria was in Cordoba, Spain, in Al-Andalus. It's something that doesn't appear often in the Western appreciations of history. It's a remarkable, most even educated Westerners are not really aware of the fact that Spain was Islamic for 700 years.
Right.
But as early as the 10th century, in Cordoba, under the Caliph Abdurrahman III, who actually proclaimed himself the Caliph, the true successor of Muhammad, you had an absolutely phenomenal creation there with this great library of 400,000 texts, many of which did come from the Greek world. Some of it had gone up to Constantinople, because Constantinople really rises after Alexander falls. Byzantium, Constantinople. Then I was just reading that there were various schismatic disputes in Constantinople, and the followers of Arian were expelled. He was pronounced a heretic, and many of them fled into the deserts of Syria. So they took a lot of these the Greek writings into Syria, and also, of course, in the heyday of the Caliph of Baghdad, Harun al-Rashid, and so on, when Baghdad was created as a sacred city by the Abbasid dynasty, there was a huge amount of translation of Greek philosophy and Greek technology and science. And so you have to visualize camel trains making their way across North Africa from the Middle East, and we're filled with translations of Greek works. And so it was the Greek technology and science that enabled the arid world of Al-Andalus to bloom, but it was also Greek philosophy as well. The greatest of the Andalusian Sufis, Ibn Arabi, considered the Sheikh Al-Akbar the greatest of all Sufis in the Arabic tradition anyway. Was itself influenced by Neoplatonism. So there's definitely a Neoplatonic connection with the Sufi world, although Sufis are reluctant to talk about it today. I've tried talking about Sufis in Istanbul, and they say it's true, but we don't like to talk about it, because, of course, the fundamentalists use it then to accuse them of not really being Muslims. But yes, that whole world of Al-Andalus, you could argue, that it didn't last for that long. At its apex, there was the time of struggle, the fitna became
not long after, but there was a wonderful apex there about the 10th to the 9th and 10th century in Cordoba. Yes. Do we have one last question before we wind it up for the night? Well, too long. Yeah.
Can I ask you why you mentioned Pythagoras?
Why didn't I mention Pythagoras? You can't mention everything. That's the only reason. But we could, of course, we could have mentioned Pythagoras. Pythagoras is said to have spent time in Egypt on his travels, where he acquired a lot of his wisdom before he established his schools.
The what? The mathematics.
Well, so many things, yes. Absolutely. The system itself.
Well, he's part, of course, of the Axial Age, 500 BC. So I think the reason he was left out, at least in my comments, I was trying to focus on AD. You know, I mean, I thought that was, but clearly he would have been very much a part of Hypatia's teaching, and the assumption, of course, of the reality of number, and the fact that number is alive, it is a fundamental form, in which is Plato's debt to Pythagoras. He's that understanding.
All right, one more.
Sorry. Question for Richard. I had heard over that it seemed as though there were systematic destructions of at least parts of the library over periods, over centuries. Diocletian ordered.
There's a fire.
Yeah, when did that take place, approximately? Or, well, anyway,
71 BC.
Oh, really?
Is that ring a bell?
It wasn't when Caesar was there. There was a fire.
Yes,
Diocletian ordered the alchemical texts were there to be destroyed in his time. That was like before 300.
Yeah, I have no.
Then Omar. That was much later. Then wasn't it? And that was during
that. I just know that at one point, all of the great texts of the fifth century BC were stored in Alexandria, and they were destroyed or lost.
I've just found a program by Carl Sagan in his Cosmos series about the where he actually walked into the remaining structures or wherever of. Said there were like a million scrolls had been there, but he talked about something called the Books of Berossus that I had never heard of.
Knowing Sagan, he probably was there.
Yeah, he actually was filmed there. Yeah, but who was a Babylonian who wrote? This is one of the books that was supposedly lost. Who had written a history of the world going back to like 40,000 BC or something?
Well, of course, you know they haven't found the library yet.
Uh-huh.
They don't know where the library was.
They don't know where it is?
The ancient library. They haven't found it.
Uh-huh. The organic material, the scrolls probably gone anyway.
No, I mean, it was a huge.
Is it underwater, though, at this point? I mean,
I mean, the new library was not built on the foundations of the old. I know that. So, they don't know where it
was. What if they found them in Alexandria?
Well, they found a bunch of extraordinary statues. You know, they found the most recent discovery is the mausoleum of Cleopatra. Mm-hmm.
Buildings also?
Couldn't tell you the details. There's this guy here. I want to recommend some books. And this guy here, what's his name? Frenchman. Jean-Yves Empereur. I'll write it out. He has a little book here called Alexandria, Jewel of Egypt. And this guy is actually a French, he's a diver as well as an archaeologist. So he's leading the French team in those aquatic explorations. If you Google him, he may have the latest information on it. But let me just write this guy's name up. Nice little book.
All
times, and Empera,
Empera, you know, Empera,
Empera.
French. Jean-Yves Empera.
I just brought some books. You know, we'll put these all up on the Esoteric Quest website. But that Alexandria, Jewel of Egypt by Jean-Yves Empera, The Complete Poems of Kabafi, really take you imaginatively into scenes like The God Forsakes Antony. This classic illustrated Alexandria, that's the kite we fought, that is still there, right? That's pretty much where the Pharos Lighthouse used to stand. It's out on that tip, out on that peninsula. So that's an Alexandria illustrated by Michael Haag, H-A-A-G. Here's a little one I was just reading, E.M. Forster. You know, if you go to those hotels along the Corniche of Alexandria, nothing's changed since they were built around 1902, 1906. It's got this faded Art Deco-ish charm around it, and it really does look as if Agatha Christie's going to wander around the corner and order a gin and tonic, or E.M. Forster, or one of these guys. So E.M. Forster was there. He was a friend of Kabafi, and he wrote this little book, Pharos and Pharaoh, a novelist sketchbook of Alexandria through the ages. So it's just E.M. Forster's little impressionistic sketches of Philo's journey to Rome to meet with Caligula and little things like that. You know, we wouldn't call it profound, but if you like E.M. Forster, it's very nice. This is something I picked up at the Bibliotheca itself. I learned a lot from it. It's about Cleopatra herself. It's by Prudence Jones. There you go, a nice simple name. Prudence Jones, Cleopatra. I don't know if you can find it. Maybe you can get it on Amazon. But it was a very nice little short book that really filled in the picture of who Cleopatra was.
There's a new book that came out
last week.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
it's the Andre Sorensen also.
Yeah. So whether it's Hypatia, whether it's Cleopatra, whether it's the Western esoteric tradition, it was finally starting to wake up. As much as we love Indian philosophy and Zen and Tibetanism and all the rest of it and shamanism, it ain't bad back in the old,
Well, needless to say, the feminist authors have taken Hypatia to their own, you know, and they're doing a lot of serious writing on that.
It's about time.
Here's a really nice overview of Alexandria that doesn't, it's not really esoterically and spiritually oriented, it just gives you a sense of the grandeur of the gargantuan cultural achievement of Alexandria. It's called The Rise and Fall of Alexandria by Justin Pollard and Howard Reed. So Pollard and Reed, The Rise and Fall of Alexandria. These guys are two British television producers who are just very affluent writers. And they've turned their hands to really a compelling and engaging portrait of Alexandria. And then this guy, I've been trying to get hold of this guy. Does anybody know how to reach him? Theodore Vretos. He lives in Massachusetts somewhere. He's a writer. He wrote this book, Alexandria, City of the Western Mind. And I can't track him down. I've tried writing to him via his publisher, etc. But he seems to be the American who has written most of, or tried to give us the clearest picture of Alexandria most succinctly in the last 10 or 15 years. Anyway, I'm going to try and track this guy down and see if we can get him to come to the Open Center and actually speak about.
Give him a tweet.
Anyway, we'll put all those books on the Esoteric Quest website and so on. Yeah, I see one last comment.
You mentioned in 1956 that there was correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a big ethnic diversity in Alexandria.
Yes.
Is it still that way?
No. Well, unfortunately, that wonderful work, so anyway, I touched on the Alexandria Quartet by Lawrence Durrell. If you haven't read it, you definitely should. Justine, Balthazar, Clea, all of this stuff. It was a scandalous book when I was a teenager, because it had all these erotic parts that were considered outrageous. But I'm glad I waited until later life to actually read it, because I wouldn't have caught the references to Kabbalah and Gnosticism and so on. But anyway, Lawrence Durrell is describing the world of Alexandria. It's really between the wars, or after the Second World War. But it had been extremely cosmopolitan for about 150 years, really ever since the modern Alexandria was constructed at the beginning of the 19th century. But then what happened was a political thing. It was the Suez Canal crisis. So some of us are old enough to remember that. Remember the British and the French and the Israelis all tried to take back the Suez Canal, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the classic Arab, the pan-Arab nationalist. He decided, he announced it in Alexandria, actually, that he was going to nationalize the Suez Canal, which, of course, was the Brits, was the key to the maintenance of their empires, even though it was tottering at that point. So the Brits and the French, with Israeli support, actually took Port Said and were ready to really take back the Suez Canal. But the U.S. President Eisenhower didn't agree with that. He really insisted that that stopped. It was a major turning point, actually, in world history in terms of power.
And the sun set on the British Empire.
The sun set on the British Empire, I know, that was a name. So, but as a result, Nasser was so furious that there'd been this imperialist incursion into a nationalistic Egypt that his response was to expel all foreigners, of course, particularly British, French, Jews, etc. Everybody was out. And so, you know, that's what's so wonderful about the Alexandria Quartet, is that it preserves a wonderful time, an amazing cosmopolitan time, actually, where you see that Justine was actually a refugee. She was from Odessa, and the hero's lover, the belly dancer, she was from Smyrna, you know, the Greek city of Smyrna, that's now Turkish Izmir, that was burnt to the ground by Ataturk's troops in 1922 at the end of the Greco-Turkish War. I mean, it's an amazing world that just doesn't exist today. So today, you know, Alexandria is a heaving, intense city of 5.5 million people without one traffic light. Or if there is one, I didn't see it. Maybe there is one somewhere. So you can imagine people get by, they lean on the horn, so there's a non-stop 24-hour cacophony of horns. That's a symbol of the state of Alexandria today. That's why when we go there for our esoteric quest, it will be the inner eye of the imagination.
Cairo
is the same way. Yeah, and you think traffic is bad in New York? I've never seen anything as crazy as traffic. It makes India look mellow in comparison. Egyptian traffic is the worst in the world. Just getting across the Corniche is a challenge. But we'll do it.
You'll work on patience.
Yeah, and daring and speed. Yeah, it's amazing how nobody seems to no cars seem to hit each other. But the people in Alexandria, even though it's this sort of febrile metropolis, I found everybody extremely friendly. I didn't get anything but good vibes from everyone.
Happy to be alive.
Good. Okay. Well, I do want to encourage you to check out Esoteric Quest and think about that esoteric gathering in August. And thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.